would.
Come here.
Hello and welcome to The Frequency of Laughter, a show about the history of radio comedy. I'm Grace Den, and this week we're looking in particular at the late 70s. So I'm joined by two giants of the genre, Graham Garden and John Lloyd. Both were in the Cambridge University footlights, but while Graham made his mark as a writer and performer in I'm Sorry I'll Read That Again and I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, John joined the BBC Radio Comedy Department as a producer, creating the News Quiz, Quote Unquote, and the News Hoodlines before leaving to become a television producer. During the show, you'll be hearing excerpts from the programmes we're talking about, as well as contributions from some other people who were around at the time. But I started by asking Graham what radio comedy, if any, he listened to as a child.
When I discovered comedy on radio, it was such a treat. I can vaguely remember, I think, my dad listening to Itmar, which I didn't really get.
You read a proclamation, Sam.
Me, boss?
Yes, you're similar to Himmler.
But then later on, I just fell in love with the whole idea of radio and listened to programmes like Jewel and Warris, Up the Pole, Take It From Here, Much Binding in the Marsh. I loved radio so much. My dad came back from the war with various bits of sort of radio equipment, including a microphone. And I rigged up a microphone from my bedroom down to the radio in the kitchen so that I could actually broadcast, which I did from time to time. The big drawback was I could never hear it.
You think you were very good?
Well, I used to go and ask my mother if I was very good. She seemed to be got quite a good review from her, yeah.
We listened to the radio all the time, you know, in the evenings and particularly on Sunday lunchtimes. That was the great thing. Round the Horn, Beyond Our Ken, the Navy Lark. My dad was in the Navy, so we just thought that was absolutely hilarious.
I've been on exercises with them before, you know. The worst time was when we went to Gibraltar.
What happened? Did they hit the rock full on?
No, no, just a glancing blow, actually.
And when people ask me subsequently, what are your influences, expecting me to say Monty Python or something like that, it's radio that formed my sense of humour.
Was there a sense there with the comedy, though, that it was multi-layered? So if you were a child, you were appreciating it, but if you were your dad, also funny?
Definitely. I mean, you know, if you've got Jules and Sandy around the horn, a lot of those jokes go right over the head of a sort of 10-year-old, and your parents would be hooting with laughter, you didn't know what they were on about.
Chair, Julian will take you. He tortures the rye. Lovely, he's got the fingers for it.
Oh. Hands of an artiste.
Oh, good. When he's done that, would you ask him to do my hair?
It's like the soup of broadcasting's gone a bit thin in places, hasn't it? It used to be a real proper mulligatawny, didn't it, Graham?
Well, yeah. I was going to just say, what are you both listening to now?
All sorts of stuff. Count Arthur Strong. Fantastic.
The Cabin Pressures. Very good.
Cabin, yeah. Oh, I loved John Finnemore's stuff, yes.
John Finnemore is a genius.
Yeah.
Count Arthur Strong, and that went to television recently?
It did. It became a different thing altogether. Was quite funny, but not the same as the radio. The radio is a...
Why do you think that was? Why do you think the radio had this strength?
I think the radio world... Well, like most things, the radio world is so full of surprises and unexpected turnings, which you can't show on television without giving them away beforehand, you know.
Or an enormous budget, which you can't have anymore.
Yeah, I mean, on radio, you can just play two sort of tinkly chords and say China, and you're in China.
Somebody said the scenery's better on the radio, you know.
Do you think there's a place for radio comedy never, ever being allowed to go to television, you know, just almost preserving the memory of it being so funny?
I wouldn't like to ban anything. What happens, unfortunately, with some shows is that they're brilliant on radio, then they go to television and are not as successful. They get cancelled on television and they don't happen on the radio anymore. Mm. Partly why we've never really pursued Clue on television. Everybody else has done it, but we haven't because, you know, there was always the fear that if it didn't work on television, then that might just be the end of it.
What do you think you would lose if it went to television?
All the pictures.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Please listen very carefully now to this very unimportant announcement.
Can we talk about David Hatch? He became head of radio comedy in 1978, but he had been in I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again with you, Graham. Was he a very good manager?
Well, I knew David sort of from Cambridge. We'd been students together. But he ended up on I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again, playing the kind of BBC figure that he was to become, the announcer, announcer Hatch, who used to go mad every now and again but also get the boring bits to say. He was always very supportive about scripts. You know, he didn't really write much himself, but he was very, very keen to let you know when something was working well. And he was wonderful at getting everybody on board, making everyone feel they were a team, making everyone know that he was taking an interest in what they did. And he used to send out little hatchlets, were they called, his notes. You must have worked for him when he
was... Yeah, well, David, really, I owe my career to David because he came down to see the Footlights in 1973 that I was in with a guy called Simon Brett. They liked the show and they commissioned one off from it. And eventually, after I'd been hanging around like a bad smell in radio trying to be a writer, they said, would you like to be a producer? And I said, no, not really. I don't know what they do. They all seem terribly old. Am I old enough to be one of those? So I worked under David for 5 years.
My name's Simon Brett. I was a producer in Radio Light Entertainment from 1968 to 1977. I think there had been a kind of gap, an age gap, with producers. And so there were quite a lot, sort of over 40, I would say, and very few younger ones. And the younger ones would tend to have come sort of through the BBC. I mean, there was one called Richard Wilcox, who used to work in the gramophone library and sort of came in that way. And there was a guy called Peter Titheridge, who was quite a lot older, and he'd been a script editor, actually, and then he became a producer. And he was the one who sort of delegated to look for this new infusion of talent, and so he had very good connections with the universities. But at that time, I mean, there wasn't any sort of comedy circuit. There was very little stand-up. Certainly the idea that every other pub would have stand-up comedians in it just didn't exist. So there's kind of the residual music hall and some rather elderly comedians. And the only place you could really look for which specialised in comedy was the universities. I mean, now, you know, you can pick it up on the street. I mean, there's comedy talent everywhere. There's a sort of system. But in those days, those were really the only places to look. And it sounds terribly elitist, and it probably was.
He was a very good manager, an incredibly caring person. You would arrive, you know, having worked very late, perhaps on a show like Late Night Extra, ended at midnight. You'd come in early for another show the next day, and there'd be a note on your desk from David saying, you know, heard the show last night, really good. I particularly liked, you know, the bit of music you did this with.
What was David Hatch like compared to his predecessor, Con Mahoney?
Con Mahoney wasn't a professional comedian. He had joined the BBC in the postroom, I think, as a sort of left school early, and had had a very good war, as they say, and had risen to become Provost Marshal of Naples. Always remind me of Fred Emney. Do you remember that actor?
Yes. And he was rather like that. He was sort of rather polite. And
David was the sort of fire of the department, that, you know, pushing for new ideas and all that kind of thing.
One figure who's fascinating from this period is Ian McIntyre, the controller of Radio 4 between 1976 and 1978. Now, he did a lot of things that shook things up in general. Cut the duration of Today, commissioned the first show that actually allowed listeners to complain about programmes, disgusted of Tunbridge Wells. And apparently, he once upset the head of radio drama so much they threw a chair across the room at him. Did you have any dealings with him?
I really liked Ian. I thought he was very bright and terribly nice. And it was dusty in those days, Radio 4. It mustn't get too dewy-eyed about how brilliant everything was. You know, if you were young, it all seemed, you know, fusty and a bit slow and all that. And Ian came in like a... Well, he was fresh. And one thing he did was he said, OK, he wrote to all the heads of departments, said, we all know that not every programme is your best. And he said, I want each department to nominate 11% of their output, which you don't think is really up to scratch, and I will put all that stuff into a pool and all the departments will compete for the time, so it gives you a chance to have more output if you've got good ideas. Every single head of department wrote back and saying, all my output is equally good. And he was basically forced out by conservatism and the sort of baronial powers of the departments. And it's an interesting thing. That model's changed. Departmental heads don't have power anymore. All the power's in the hands of the controllers and the schedulers and people like that.
It seems, though, that in the late 70s, this is when things really started to change, because the men from the Ministry and the Navy Lark both finish in 1977. But things like The Burkess Way and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, that's when they come along. you remember this feeling of kind of a new wave of excitement coming through?
Well, this is my life. I was 22 when I got a job, and everybody seemed terribly old in the department. And these guys had all been famous in the 60s, you know, when radio was still big at the beginning of the 60s, and the 50s particularly, where they were getting audiences of 25 million on a Saturday night for things like In Town Tonight or whatever. And so I felt really a fish out of water, and I remember particularly when I shared an office with a guy called John Browell, and he'd say things like, I'm just interviewing my vintner later. He's popping by for some nice Spanish sherries. And or another time his tailor came in and measured him up for a suit, you know. And that turned round, really, in the 5 years I was there, it turned absolutely upside down. Suddenly everybody was young. You had Griffries Jones and then Geoffrey Perkins, Jimmy Mulville, Rory McGrath, Douglas Adams. And it suddenly felt, you know, by 1977 or so, it felt like a young advertising agency. And when David came, head of the department, it was just an extraordinary, the most exciting job I've ever had. And the productivity was extraordinary. I made 500 shows between 1974 and 1979. That's a lot of output, because you've got this fantastic freedom. If you had a good idea, it would get made.
Did you get to work with any of your heroes from your radio listening days?
Kenneth Williams, of course, had a show there, so got to know Ken pretty well. He used to come into my office. He liked to know some of the subject matter in advance, because he was a bit of a historian, so he liked to read up on William the Fourth or whatever, just so he'd have something to say that was interesting. And he used to come into my office in his little grey Mac. He was grey, you hardly noticed him in the street. He was so wispy. He'd come in and he would make me laugh for 2 hours. I would be, you know, crying with laughter, lying on the floor, unable to breathe. Always very rude, of course, you know, fantastically rude stories.
Especially if ladies were present. He used to enjoy telling the rudest stories. It was mixed company.
And then he would just drift out again in his grey Mac down the Marylebone Road to his flat. And I could never remember a single thing he'd said to me.
I was going to talk about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in the moment. Can I just go back to the Birkis way?
Mr. Gradner, I've got Jack Cousteau on the line.
Well, throw him back.
Yes, sir.
The Birkis way is written by Andrew Marshall and David Romwick, who were just nonpareil as writers, fantastically good as a team. And the Birkis way was an incredibly inventive, what do you say, sort of Radio Python, sort of humbug somewhere between your sort of goodies, Python-y, I don't know what.
I thought it sort of took a step forward from, I'm sorry, I'll read that again, really. Joe Kendall was in it.
I refuse to be kissed by this drunken lecherous pig.
Oh, take the pig with you.
Yes, sir.
And it sort of took that into the next dimension, really.
When shows like The Birkis Way were first coming through on radio, did you sense like that the listeners at home were flabbergasted at this type of surreal thing? I mean, were you getting letters? People saying?
I mean, we were sort of very up for anything, really. And The Birkis Way specialised in what were called sort of pre-title sequences, you know, before the sequence, before you knew what the programme was, of doing parodies of something else. But the one I remember was... And now, from Norwich, Nicholas Parsons invites you to go to the lavatory. And then, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We had a torrent of letters, people saying, "Dear sir, I'm probably on disgusted tumble as well. I've just heard a programme on Radio 4 called Go to the Lavatory with Nicholas Parsons. Has the BBC sunk so low?" It was just fantastic. We had such fun.
It almost got all switched off immediately. Yes, yes.
Do you think we can trust him?
Myself, I'd trust him to the end of the earth.
Yes, but how far's that?
About 12 minutes away. Come on, I need a drink.
I'm going to talk to you about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Was this a real game changer?
I think the difference in the comedy was that, like all good science fiction, it's not about robots and spaceships. It's about a commentary on current social, technical issues. And Hitchhiker's was full of Douglas's quirky observations about the way we live. And I think that's always been science fiction's great thing. And to combine that with comedy was... I think it was, in that sense, a game-changer.
It's also the flavour of some of these new shows, The Birkis Way is one, and The News Quiz, which I started in 1977. It's difficult to put your finger on it, but as an example, Nicholas Parsons came and said, "I've got this idea for a quiz about the news." I said, "Well, that's an interesting idea." And we did this pilot, and it was very jolly, you know, in a sort of way, but it just didn't work because it was all about the stories in the tabloids, little unimportant, silly things. I showed this to David Hatch, and he said, it doesn't really work, does it? It seems really a bit old-fashioned and everything. So he said, but I tell you what, the idea of a quiz about the news is really good. Why don't you have another go? Which they would say to you, and so we did a second pilot. So I thought, well, let's say what it is. It's not going to have a funny time. It's actually about the news. It's called the News Quiz. And we'll only have journalists in it. That was a big step forward.
Did these journalists have much broadcasting experience?
No, they were all new. They were astonished to be asked. And again, it was that cross-generic thing. The minute you heard it, you thought, something's happened here. This is different. It had a modernity about it and a sharpness, and it also was very unpatronising. It was very, you know, high-end.
I think it's the first number of the new Mini which isn't going to come off the Leyland assembly line.
Oh, oh, a big hand, please, for Mr. Alan Crawley. Shame. Very good. You've been reading the papers. Haven't you anything better to do?
I've been ordering Minis. I've been told it's only a 14-year-old.
And was this far more off the cuff rather than comedians coming in with written lines? I mean, were these people just kind of...
Nobody wrote anything. Richard Ingrams couldn't even be bothered to read the papers.
Well, he never knew anything.
He never did. It was terribly funny. And Alan knew everything because Alan was very, very bright and read all the papers as a matter of course because he was interested. So he always knew the answer to everything immediately, and Richard never... You and Clive be rather dry in the background.
The moral here is if you want something preserved in your village or town, make sure that a lot of MPs live there.
But it's this cross-generic thing that's so interesting that was happening in the 70s because the producers who were there before came from a very different background. They'd been in the army or they were, they'd risen up through the system. They were sort of, they weren't Oxbridge types, really. Those people that were obviously performer writers who were that, apart from David. And, for example, we started the News Headlines in 1976, me and Simon Brett. So Simon's Oxford-educated English graduate. And Roy Hudd from Music Hall, you know, South London boy, working class. And the mixture of bright, young, university-educated writers and Roy, with his amazing timing and natural stage presence and fantastic sense of humour, was extraordinary. We were both learning so much off the other. Because Roy didn't have to do jokes about mothers-in-law anymore. He could talk about anything. And so it's no accident. That show ran for, I think it was 23 years. I think it's the longest-running sketch show on radio or television. And then we came to the end. There was some head of department who swanned in for a short time, and he took Roy out to lunch, and he said, I'm afraid we're going to cancel the show, Roy, because you're not really much like Jonathan Ross. Roy said, sorry, I wasn't aware. I didn't know that was part of the brief, but that was the reason for getting rid of it. And I think it's sadly missed, because that's where Spitting Image comes from, essentially, is from the News Headlines, showing that you can be extremely funny about perhaps boring or important or difficult public events in a way that anybody can understand. And that's really where I learned my craft.
Pull! Pull!
Philip, don't do that in the Vatican.
John, can I talk to you a little bit about Footlights? Your Footlights colleagues followed you into radio comedy at Griffith Jones, Rory McGrath, Clive Anderson, Jimmy Mulville. Was this influx of new talent, would you say it was coincidental, or were you all talking to each other and saying, come in, this is a great job?
This Footlights thing, you know, as if somehow you're born like a duke into the Footlightsdom. It's not like that. So we all came from very different backgrounds. And yes, we're friends, and we'd all become friends at university, but there's a thing in the wind sometimes when a group of people all get to know each other and work together. It's not exactly a team thing, but there's a sort of spirit that takes place, which means that everybody gets better. Mm-hmm. And we undoubtedly all have done better than we might have done if we'd done it on our own. Rather like with Graham's, you know, as a writer, you help each other in that way. It's better if there's more than one of you. And so it produced this sort of efflorescence of talent, really, both performing and producing and writing.
I like this idea that you're saying that you almost kind of all pushed each other to be better and to do better things. Graham, do you think that this new influx, did they push you to be better? Do you think this kind of pushed the Clue team to think, oh, this kind of new guard coming in, did they push people to be better?
I think, yes, they keep you on your toes. I mean, like John, I came in as a gang with, in fact, the cast, if I'm sorry, I'll read that again, really. Yeah. None of us, I think, had any ambitions to go into show business, except possibly Bill Hoddy.
Well, Bill was the star,
he was totally the star of the Student Review, and when it toured, went on Broadway for a time, yeah.
What was it that Bill had?
Songs.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a beard. No.
No, he didn't. In those days.
Songs. It was the songs.
It was the songs. That's what he did. He's a very good songwriter.
Oh, when I was a little baby.
Ah.
I had a winsome way.
Oh.
Of choosing funny objects with which I love to play.
It's a winkle joke.
No, it isn't.
We kind of gave each other the courage to give it a go. I think, you know, the generation before, they all came out of the army, we came out of university, and then another generation has come out of all sorts of places, from stand-up in particular. The huge flowering of stand-up, which happened because of the equity ruling, wasn't it, that you could earn your equity card by doing stand-up.
Ah.
So you didn't have to get a job, you just find an open mic somewhere.
I tell you, it's a very, very interesting thing I learned 2 days ago, which is what we always say when you're doing panel games. We say the reason there aren't as many women is because that's what the intake is. You know, 10 times, I used to say 10 times as many men as women want to be stand-ups at all. So you can't see them; there just aren't any. But my producer on Museum of Curiosities, that's all changed in the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. That it's now about 50-50. As many girls want to give it a go as men. So that's really exciting, isn't it? That will really produce a change, I think.
I was going to speak to you about back then. Were there any women working in radio comedy?
As producers, there was one in the department. She was called Yvonne Littlewood, and she did music shows. And she wouldn't claim to be a comedy producer, but, you know, light entertainment was entertainment of all kinds. It's so difficult, Grace, to remember how different the world was in the 70s. And actually, it's interesting that I came out of university and we all considered ourselves in the mid-70s, not to be sexist. We thought of women as being equals. They were friends and all that kind of thing. But we were still sort of taken sort of 40 years for that, you know, theoretical feminism to make itself felt in a social way, which is if half the country stand-up comics are women, then that's a real difference. That is a terrific and exciting new thing. And you can see they're winning all the prizes in Edinburgh these days, the young comics.
What do you think life was like for Yvonne, working as the only woman in so many men?
Well, I think that was the way the world was. It would have been the same in hospitals and, you know, banks and everything else. As we know, it was odd that there were none.
I'm Yvonne Littlewood, a long-term serving member of BBC Light Entertainment. I was the only woman producer, and I don't really know why. I've been thinking about this. There were a lot of women who were assistants to producers, either production, the secretaries were called then, or one or two production managers who also were women. It didn't really bother me. I suppose I'd grown up in a sort of man's world, and I was never asked to produce comedy, because I think, first of all, they had so many excellent comedy producers, they weren't exactly looking round for somebody else to do something. I mean, my friend Sid Lotterby, who got his job the day I did, I mean, he specialised in, you know, Yesminster and all those wonderful things, and I got a pretty big schedule going, and they had enough comedy producers. The fact that they weren't women, I mean, there were women who worked on them as PAs, and then, of course, in latter years, I think there were more than directors. I think Susan Belbin and Mandy Fletcher. I think I always thought I was very lucky to be doing it at all, and the fact that I was doing something I had a feeling for, and you know, but I wouldn't have wanted to give up not a day of my job with my dots and crosses and music. I really, it was something too special. I miss it now. And, you know, I respected the comedy and I enjoyed watching it, but it never occurred to me that I might like to produce it.
I mean, the BBC has quite a reputation for quite forceful and successful women in high office. Grace Wyndham Goldie was fantastically influential.
Absolutely.
So there are people like that. I mean, and now, of course, there are lots of female producers.
But, you know, believe me, as producers, the struggle to find any women who were prepared even to say they were a comedy writer was very difficult. I mean, there just weren't people. It wasn't coming in. And in Footlights, I'm sure it was true in Graham's year, on the whole, the girls didn't write the jokes. They were in because they might be, funny physical comics, you know, like a Joe Candle. But the boys wrote the jokes and the girls said them, really.
In my day at the Footlights, we didn't have any female members at all. Mm. It was a male club. I mean, the Footlights started out as a sort of theatrical club for chaps to dress up as ladies. Mm. And they used to do these strange sort of musicals.
Yes, sort of Noel Coward.
And there was a movement afoot, absolutely, to bring women in as full members of the club while I was there. Unfortunately, our treasurer, Harry Porter, the lovely old Don, just wouldn't countenance it. So the fight started then.
What was his problem? What was the main problem?
It was a gentleman's club.
Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, a safe refuge for any whistleblower prepared to spill the beans of interestingness.
What keeps you both coming back to radio after all this time?
They'll have us. But I just love radio. And, going back to what we were saying about early influences and things, it was extraordinary to meet people who had been immortalised in the pages of Radio Fun, the comic. People like Arthur Askey, I worked with once. They were just sort of legends, as far as I was concerned, from my childhood. And to be part of that sort of fabric, I still just feel very, very comfortable here.
Everybody likes doing radio. You can call anyone and they will come. Even when I was a baby radio producer, Nigel Rees and I started, quote-unquote, in 1976. And I said, why don't we ring Jonathan Miller or Tom Stoppard? OK, so we did. So they came on, you know. You get absolutely anybody because you don't have to shave.
Terry Wogan, first of all, can you tell me who confessed to this in 1977?
I suppose I'm the most insulted guy since Hitler.
It's either Des O'Connor or Max Bygraves.
It's Des O'Connor, too much.
But it is absolutely a joy, and it's what radio can, always has been able to do, is a deliciously rich mixture of comedy and really, really interesting information. It makes you proud to be a member of the species.
That was The Frequency of Laughter, presented by me, Grace Dent, with Graham Garden and John Lloyd and Simon Brett and Yvonne Littlewood. A list of the clips we've used is on the Radio 4 website. The producers were Ed Morrish and Alexandra Smith.